This is Walt Richter speaking from a KLM Dakota DC-3 above the flooded disaster area. We left Schiphol Airport about a half an hour ago and have been steadily flying south. And as we slowly approached the disaster area, we began seeing signs of the flood waters which have encroached upon so much of this land which has been won through so much hard toil from the sea during the past centuries. This disaster rates, I think, is the greatest in Holland's history for the past 300 years.
Water. Water, just water. And just when you look around you, you could hardly see. It was the 1st of February. It was winter time. I mean, it was dark. So you didn't see much. And what you saw is floating things, floating straw bales. The dog floated away on a straw bale. I mean, the cattle climbing in water without nothing to find to stand on, of course.
They never expected so much water. So a lot of people got surprised in their bed and in their house. The people were hanging on the gutters of the roof, and that roofs with people of it on top of it, floating out of the holes in towards the ocean.
Another thing is the powerlessness by seeing their friends, family, neighbors drowning without you was capable to do anything. You saw them on the roofs, you saw it, and then at once, then they disappeared under the wreckage. You see, there was not real clean water. It was terrible, dark and dirty water was coming. And cold, of course, very, very cold.
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents Zeeland 53.
Saturday, January 31st, 1953. Princess Beatrix receives a transatlantic call from her father, Prince Bernard, wishing her a happy 15th birthday. But they are both unaware of a storm brewing off the coast in the North Sea.
My name is Nick Buters. I was living in Zeeuws-Vlaanderen, that's a part of the Netherlands attached to Belgium along the Westerschelde. And to get to it from the rest of the country, you had to cross by ferry. And it was all polder. It was sea clay with big dikes around it. And that afternoon when I was coming over with the ferry from the other side from Kruiningen, I mentioned to my wife how high the water in the Westerschelde was.
My name is Ria Geluk. And I was 6.5 when the flood was there. So our farm was in fact in the middle on a very small village, Capelle, what has about disappeared even in the floods. And the Saturday, not so much happened. I mean, it was a storm, it was a hard wind. And in fact, we were at home, my parents, my sister and I. And we had visitors that Saturday night, the neighbors, they came regularly Saturday night. They played cards with my parents. And then the children of them, they stayed over the night. And in the early morning, in the middle of the night, you can say, at 4 o'clock, the house doctor came to warn us that the dikes had broken. And he came because he was around in the polder because he had to deliver a baby.
My father, who was a doctor here, he was warned by people from Capelle. And they asked him to come because his baby has to be born there. And the doctor from Zierikzee couldn't come. So he went there. And afterwards he went to Zierikzee and he saw that Zierikzee, we called it the Gouden Veerspolder, was already full of water.
Because Anna van der Zander's father was a doctor, They were one of the few families in Zeeland with a telephone, but most of the lines were shut down after 9 p.m. So in the early hours of Sunday, February 1st, the few warnings about the impending disaster came from neighbors, if they came at all.
At night time, at about 1 o'clock, there was a banging on our window, and René During, he warned me that the dike reef was afraid that the dikes wouldn't hold the water, and so we better get up and out. And we had an air alarm siren there on the factory, what was used to give the times of starting and stopping, and you could hear it for about 20 kilometers away, and he started making an alarm with that for about 20 minutes.
But nobody could believe it, because everybody thought, oh, that's just fake, something like that. And when the water will come, it will not be higher as it was in the war.
And I got my wife and our eldest son, who was then just 1 year old, and we got just clothes and some food for the baby boy, and we tried to get to the dike, but there were lampposts on the dike, and the water was that high that you could see the waves rolling over the dike, like you see when a motorboat is going along the shore at high speed. You see that wave rolling, and so one wave after another you saw going over the dike and rolling over. And so much water was coming down that we thought that it would be a bit too dangerous to continue to the dike. So we went to other friends who lived a bit higher in the stone house.
And then two of the workmen of my father, they lived close by, and they came to the farm to help with milking the cows and this kind of thing on the farm. Because nobody realized on that moment, even the dikes were broke, that what would happen. So we were with 9 people altogether, 4 of us, 3 neighbor kids and 2 workmen.
I started directing all the men to go to the precast concrete factory to fill sandbag, and I more or less confiscated hessian bags from stock merchants and every truck available, and let it all go to the precast concrete factory, because there was a lot of sand, and the people started filling the sandbags. And from my friend the dike reef, I got directions where they wanted the material, and so we sent trucks with people and sandbags to those spots. It was done in that way, and then about an hour before high tide, about 20 meters of retaining wall just in front of the village collapsed. And that was a stone wall of about a meter high, and I reckon about 1.5 or 2 stones wide. And about 20 meters came out in one go, so a meter of water was going over the dike there. And we tried to stop it by putting sandbags down there. And if one of every 3 sandbags stayed on the spot where we put it, then we were lucky. It was just over the 20 meters, as if they had put a knife in the center and just removed one side. It went just straight down. That was unbelievable.
So it came from everywhere, and it came like a wall of water. He was looking outside and said, "What's that? What's that?" And then it was there. A high wall with foam on it, and already a lot of wreckage, of course, dead trees and from buildings. It came to the houses and it destroyed the houses.
And the water came already from, let's say, 5, 6, 7 in the morning, came the water in the polder, and came so quickly that the man had to stop the work in the stable, in the barn, had to come in the house. And that also made that all our cattle anyway has drowned, because they were still in the stables with the ropes and everything in them. They couldn't lose them. So horses, we had cattle, we had pigs, we had chickens, we had a dog, we had cats. Everything, all the cattle has drowned. and we were saved in the house. The two workmen couldn't go back anymore to their wives. One of the wives of the workmen drowned also. And the nine of us were stuck in the house, like all families were stuck in the houses.
And then they thought, oh, we have had it, it is terrible, it has been terrible. But then another flood came all over the first one. So it was much higher as before. And that was the time when a lot of people were drowned.
The water came higher and higher, and we had quite a good house. Well, what is a good house? A firm house. The barn disappeared, the complete big barn of the farm and other barns disappeared. Maybe that rescued our house a bit, because the parts of the stone of the walls maybe were kind of breaking the waves for the house. But the house kept it. In fact, the house saved our lives. We spent the whole night on the roof.
And then by daybreak, when the water, the high tide was gone, we had the big damage to all the dikes. And to make the dikes safe, we needed about 1,000 people for repairs. So the dikerie phoned Hilversum Radio to ask if the people would come to the dikes. But they wouldn't pass on that message. And then one had the bright idea to let all the priests send the people, because it was on a Sunday, that come to church, out of church to the dikes. And people were arriving in their Sunday clothes with brand new shovels. And oh, we had a lot of people there. And so we had secured that dike for the next night.
On Monday, February 2nd, word of the flood spread quickly and help began pouring in. Radio Netherlands reporters raced to the scene and broadcast the news of the disaster to the world.
This is Robin Simpson speaking from the island of Walcheren in the southwest corner of Holland. This area is one of the richest agricultural parts of the Netherlands and one which has many historic connections with Great Britain. Now, with this catastrophe resulting from the two nations' mutual enemy, the North Sea, we, like the coastal population of Britain, are suffering ravages hard to realize and appreciate in these times of so-called civilized progress. 1/6 of the Netherlands has been inundated, and although the waters which have broken down the dikes have receded to some extent, there still remains much to be learned from vast areas which have been cut off as a result of severed communications. The death roll, which now is known to be in the tragic region of 500, is still mounting. Now, aid is being rushed from Great Britain. America and Belgium have come to our aid as well. The task is by no means a light one. After the strategic bombing of the dikes in Walcheren by the Allies at the end of the last war, it took 4 years to eradicate the salt from the soil and make it once more fertile. It's a task which has to be faced all over again.
The spirit of the Dutchman here, I think, can be best demonstrated by a group of farmers I saw who were rather ruefully surveying their land from a high point along a dike, who, as we passed over, waved at us to say, well, we did it before and we'll do it again. Another point that showed the flood here is the fact that we're 40 miles inland and still we see seagulls cruising over the waves. We passed over something that must have been a sport park. The reason I could see it, recognize it as such, was because the goalposts of the football fields were just peeking up above the water. Indeed, this is something I've never seen anything like this before, ladies and gentlemen. It's... I'm at a loss for words.
This is Brian Matthew reporting from an airfield in Gilse Rijen in the Brabant area, and there is here a squadron of helicopters flown by British pilots who have been engaged since the second day of the floods in rescue and relief operations over the flooded area. I have with me at the moment Lieutenant Commander Spering, who is the, well, what are you exactly? Perhaps you could tell us that.
I am the commanding officer of the Royal Naval Helicopter Training Squadron.
Now, could you tell us just what your work has mainly consisted of since you've been here?
Apart from one Dutch helicopter, we were the first helicopters to arrive here. Our first job was to take radio sets and radio operators out to isolated places so that they could get some sort of contact with the mainland. I then suggested that we took Dutch officers with us who spoke English. We either lured them by winch into places, and they organized landing grounds by cutting down trees and telephone posts and that sort of thing. Owing to the number of places that one landed at, it was often very difficult to remember where you'd left the chap. And we did have one. We left him in an isolated village all night. And he organized the whole village completely, did a magnificent job of work. And he told me a rather interesting story, which was two soldiers were rowing round in a boat, and they were going past a house which was almost underwater, and as they went past the bedroom window, they saw a 9-month-old baby in the cot, and they took him out.
No other sign of life there at all, just this baby?
Absolutely none at all, no.
The weather was, yeah, it was winter time. It was cold, it was snowing, it was, and that's also that a lot of people drowned, of course, because they were falling and gliding in the water. And no way when you're in that water on the 1st of February that you are rescued. And then in the Monday afternoon, we were rescued by people who came in rowboats and rowing boats. They came in the polder and they started to take people out of their houses and bring to the dike and bring to Zierikzee, the nearest by town, 3 kilometers from our farm. And they started to row in the polder and try to take everybody with them. So we were taking with a man who was of a mussel fisherman who had his rowboats.
On the Monday with the dike reef, we went along the older polders in the immediate neighborhood, and we came by Hellegat, that the name already says it, Hell's Hole. There was a big dike burst, and the polders there were flooded. And there was an inner dike with a bridge and a drain going under the bridge towards the ocean, with sluice gates in front of it. And all the farmers were standing there near the bridge because the outside seawater was pushing through the sluice gates, trying to fill the polder behind. So to work out what had happened, I asked the people, and they said they threw in sandbags, but that didn't help. So I asked one of them to fill a bag with hay and a big lump of stone in it, and then a strong rope on it, and they tied it to the railing of the bridge and threw it over, and straight away the rope was tied, and I knew where the hole in the planking of the sluice gate was.
Well, listeners, I'm just going down the line now. The wind is whistling round my ears. It's frightfully cold. It's about I don't know what the temperature is now, but it feels about 20 below, but I'm sure it isn't quite as low as that. But it's now just coming up for 5:30 in the morning, and I'm going towards a party of men who are working with a huge pile of sandbags, and they're trying to bridge a gap in a dike. I'm going now to see if I can have a word with the leader of the party. I think, yes, here, this is the leader of the party. He's dressed as a first lieutenant. Oh, yes, in this dim light, I think it's Mr. Hoofstraten,
yeah,
the gentleman.
Right, that's right, all right.
Well, how are things going with you, Mr. Hoofstraten?
Well, it's pretty bad because the dike was broken where we were working, but we are putting all our force in. Perhaps the listeners in Canada may be interesting to hear something from a Canadian student who is studying at Amsterdam Mathematics, Mr. Gilmore.
Oh, Mr. Gilmore, what is your impression so far of this wonderful work you're putting in here?
It's a bit hopeless. We, at times, our sandbags, as we put them in, are swept away, but it's a problem of just keep on going through. Certainly it is much better with the wind down and the tide not so high.
The tide is down now, and you feel that you are actually gaining ground, do you?
Oh, certainly.
So, from Middelburg, in the island of Walcheren in the south of Holland, I return you now to the studio and hope to bring you better news shortly.
This is Walt Richter of Radio Nederland speaking from the Netherlands. More than 1 million people have been struck by disaster, and although the casualty lists already total more than 1,000 dead, complete reports are not expected for days. Nature seems to have turned all her forces and resources against this suffering population. The visitor to Holland will have seen the tranquil beauty of this country's orchards. But today, even an orchard is a weapon of death. In one very graphic picture, in one of the Dutch newspapers, one sees a man helplessly clinging to the last few boards of his upended house, while only 100 yards away, his one means of escape to safety, a rubber life raft, lies helplessly entangled in the branches of one of the trees in his orchard. Help is being rushed south as fast as possible to all of the stricken areas, over land, water, and through the air. But there just aren't enough boats.
Well, we're now on the back of one of these amphibious vehicles, which they call a duck. It belongs to the American Army, and right now we are making our way through the water in the flooded areas here in southern Holland. I'll tell you a bit now about the operations of these ducks. They are all centered in a town called Steenberge, which is right on the edge of the flood area. There are two ducks in our group now, and each with a crew of three German soldiers and with a German lieutenant in charge. I think if I hold the mic over the edge here, you can probably hear the water swirling past. These ducks are mighty vehicles plowing our way through here. And now we're coming to another little town, or what remains of it. A road sign passes by, completely submerged, with only the top line showing over the water. Here's another home, submerged completely, not a soul. We've seen the same sights in every town we've visited in these last few hours. And up on the dry land, where the evacuees are coming in, there are hundreds of, and thousands of them waiting for help in the way of food and clothing and possibly financial aid from the different centers. We visited some of these centers, and I was absolutely appalled by the number of children and wives and men that were wearing the black patch of mourning on their sleeves.
We're now in the big hall, standing in that part of it which is devoted to a nursery. I think you can probably hear the children crying in the background. It is here that all those children under the age of about 10 are taken care of. Babies, diapers are changed, they're being given baths, and first aid is being performed to those children who have undergone so much in the last few days. The hall itself, as I look out over it, is about 200 yards long by 100 yards wide, and almost every inch of floor space is covered with stretchers with beds, for it'll be necessary for many people to sleep here tonight. As a matter of fact, the management is expecting at any time up to 10,000 refugees from one of the areas to come in here to Rotterdam, and they, of course, will have to go through here to be processed. And those of them that cannot be immediately placed with families or in hospitals will have to spend the night here. A few moments ago, I saw a young man go by on a stretcher, and I was told that he's the only survivor of a family of 13. He's completely lost the use of his legs. However, he's refused to go to a hospital, asking to be placed with a private family so that the other people of his town can come to see him and so that he won't feel too much apart from the world. But the work here being done is tremendous. All of the workers look as though they're about ready to drop in their tracks. Many of them haven't slept more than 3 or 4 hours since Sunday afternoon, and that is now about 54 hours ago. And yet there is a...
In the days that followed, the grim statistics mounted. 47,000 heads of cattle and 140,000 poultry drowned. 3,000 homes and 300 farms destroyed. Almost 200,000 hectares of land were inundated. and 1,835 people lost their lives. Through it all, the royal family visited the stricken areas. Prince Bernhard even flew his two young daughters over Zeeland to see the devastation firsthand. But what most impressed him was the spirit of his people.
I've been in, I think, every village that has been seriously hit. The first time, that is Thursday, 4 days after the flood struck, when I came, there was still, to a certain extent, people who were stricken. You would see them, they were being evacuated, they were crying, and
there wasn't much panic, though.
There was no panic. I didn't see any panic when I any place when I got there, but sadness, grief, loss of life, loss of livestock, loss of houses, all that sort of thing. You could see the first still, let us say, till Friday, and as from then, you could find I found a very marked change, and my wife did too when we checked in the evenings, to an attitude of fighting. Well, let's keep what we get, and even difficulties in evacuation. They didn't want to go, and they said, well, no, we'd rather stay. Based on the idea, we'd rather fight here.
Yes.
Same sort of spirit. We won't let the sea lick us. We're going to beat it. And,
well, that's the traditional Dutch spirit.
Yes, and I found it really that it is now in every place prevailing.
The only one who stayed were, in fact, the farmers like us, because the farm was still there and they had their farmland there, so they were permitted, of course, to stay. But even a lot of people have moved out of our area to go to the new polders in the north of the Netherlands. We were brought to our own family. We were staying later on for a month in the house of a sister of my father. And my mother didn't like it to be that far away. So then after a month, we came closer by to our own area in another family's home for half a year until October. And then most of the land was dry, of course, in October, except our polder, exactly, where was the last one closing in November.
And this last one is going down, so you can say that it was placed in position somewhere around 11 o'clock on the 6th of November, just over 9 months after the gap had been torn by the flood. If we can get a recording of the sound of the tugs hooting their joyous note as the operation is finished, we'll try to bring you that, because I'm quite sure that will convey something of the feeling of relief, something of the feeling of excitement, and something of the feeling of congratulations to all these thousands of people for their wonderful achievement in this great event, this historic occasion, the closing of the last of Holland's gaps in the dikes, which were these gaps caused by the flood last February. And there they go.
Zeeland 53 was researched and presented by Lisbeth de Backer. Additional material from Jonathan Marks and the archives of Radio Netherlands. Technical assistance by Rob Hierschop and sound design by Arnold Pieterzer. The programme was written and produced by David Swatling. This has been a Radio Netherlands presentation.